75% of Americans believe in UFOs. 30% of Americans believe UFOs are vehicles from other worlds. And 3% of Americans believe they have been abducted by aliens. That's over 8 million people. They're out there, aren't they?
Welcome to the UFO Files Show with your host, Jerry Pippin.
This is Anthony F. Sanchez, author of UFO Highway, stepping in this evening for my good friend and one of America's premier seekers of truth, Jerry Bertrand Pippin. For the regular listeners of Jerry's show, many of you know that he's battling a mysterious illness at this time. And it is not surprising to many of us in this field that someone with a platform like Jerry's, and as a man who regularly tackles conspiratorial matters, the UFO phenomena, ETs, and the paranormal, it doesn't faze us that the illness he is battling may be part of some larger plot to end his show. So from the bottom of our heart, we thank him for his work, this platform, and we also thank you, his listeners, who show up on a regular basis every week to support him right here on Inception Radio Network. Tonight, we're doing something a little bit different. First, for Inception Radio, we are conducting a panel of multiple guests to give you a preview of SAC UFOCon, an event that is taking place in Sacramento, California, this June 16th and 17th, which will feature Bill Murphy of the Sci-Fi Network's Fact or Fake Paranormal Files television show. It is a show that regularly tackles the UFO, ET, ghostly, and psychic phenomena. And SAC UFOCon will also be featuring Paul Bradford of GHI, Ghost Hunters International, along with many other major players in the UFO and paranormal communities, some of which are here tonight on the Jerry Pippin Show with me, Anthony F. Sanchez. I'd like to talk a little bit about some of the guests that I'm having appear at the SAC UFOCon event. Mel Fabregas, who many of you are familiar with and who is a good friend to Jerry Pippin, has a show himself, is going to be the master of ceremonies of the event, and also appearing will be Scotty Roberts, a theologian and expert in matters of ancient religious texts. Carrie Cassidy, who many of you know from Project Camelot, who delves deeply into the conspiratorial world, she will be appearing at that event alongside Jay Widener, who's a good friend of hers, a good friend of mine. Jay does a lot of work in the film industry. He is the producer of such films as Kubrick Odyssey, and he also has a book, a great book on alchemy. The title escapes me at the moment, but Jay will be there, as will Norio Hayakawa from Rio Rancho, New Mexico, by way of Los Angeles. Norio will be touching on the Dulce topic. He will also be talking on Area 51, which he is a renowned expert in. Everybody knows that Norio was one of the key, pivotal, original players in the entire phenomena surrounding Area 51. That brings me to Paula Harris. Paula Harris is going to be appearing. She recently wrote a fantastic book with Clifford Stone, recalling his involvement in the military with relation to the work that he did regarding the whole UFO phenomena. Also appearing tonight here on the radio and at the event is Micah Hanks. Micah Hanks is the well-known author, and he publishes a wonderful website called The Grailian Report, and we're excited to have Micah tonight with us. It's going to be something of a treat for most of you because he has a book out called Mysticism and the Molecule, which delves into a lot of the spiritual aspect of like the paranormal and that type of platform. So that's going to be something that we're excited to discuss this evening. David Weatherly. Recently I saw David Weatherly speak at a lecture in Santa Paula, California, where he delved deeply into the subject of tulpas. A tulpa is a being that is manifested out of pure thought, and my goodness, he gave such a wonderful lecture. Everybody who was in attendance nearly gave him a standing ovation, and it was just an amazing treat for those of us that were there in Southern California that weekend to engage with Mr. Weatherly. And his new book, which is called The Black-Eyed Children, is a hit among the communities right now. It's just it's doing wonderful as far as book sales, and the subject matter is just unbelievable. So we're glad to have David with us tonight. Also in attendance is Lyle Blackburn. Lyle Blackburn is the author of The Beast of Boggy Creek. He has a website called Monstro Bizarro. It's a blog where he's a regular featured writer and contributor to the Rue Morgue website. And he'll be appearing at SAC UFO Con, and he's going to be telling us about The Beast of Boggy Creek, the true story of the Falk monster. That is Falk, Arkansas, where the whole phenomena or the legend originates from. So we're excited to have him. Many of you are very familiar with Ike Bishop, who every year holds the Alamo UFO Conference. It's a prestigious little event held right there in the shadow of Area 51. Ike Bishop is going to be giving a lecture this year on Bob Lazar, George Knapp, and that whole group, how the whole phenomenon of Area 51 originated. So having him and Noria Hayakawa together is a real treat. Jeffrey Gonzalez, who had his tonsils pulled out today, who couldn't make it with us this evening. Jeffrey is the founder of Sanger Paranormal Society and is the former state section director for Central California MUFON, covering the entire Fresno area, which is a major metropolitan area in Central California. He's going to be giving us a presentation on some of the ghostly apparitions that appear there in the Sanger area and the greater Fresno metropolitan area. Lots of stuff happening there. It's amazing just how many television shows from major networks like Sci-Fi, the Discovery Channel, National Geographic find their way into Fresno, California, and the surrounding areas like Clovis and Sanger. Whether it's UFO or whether it's the paranormal, that area seems to be a hot spot, and it's within the infamous Triangle Valley, extending from Nevada all the way down to Southern California and up to Northern California. One of the episodes of UFO Hunters covered the Triangle Alley. Bob Oliver is going to be appearing. Bob is the host of the Quantum Leap radio show out of Monterey, California, and he regularly pops up at these events here throughout California and is well-known throughout the UFO community as one of the most outspoken radio hosts. And he's just a all-around good guy. And he's a good friend of Ed Grimsley's. Ed is going to be my first guest tonight. And Ed is out of Calistoga, California. Ed is most known for his appearances on national network news like Fox and CNN, where he's appeared as an expert on various UFO news items. And mostly for this historic meeting that took place in San Jose, California, a couple years back at the UFO Congress, when Congress was still held in California. This is when he met with George Norrie of Coast to Coast and proved to him that something or someone, possibly off-world even, is definitely operating in low Earth orbit in the most unusual of ways. So I'd like to welcome my first guest tonight, Ed Grimsley. Ed, why don't you... first of all, welcome to the show. And why don't you start off by telling us about that encounter that you had with George Norrie? What was that all about?
Well, I had never been to a UFO show until a few years back, and I was always studying on my own and using my night vision goggles and looking into it. And I went down, and I was in an area that a lot of people were in and listened to people. And it suddenly realized that a lot of people believed in them and never had saw them. And I thought, well, that's strange. I should still tell people how you can see them. So when I mentioned that, the audience, they flipped out and said, well, wow, how can you do that? And so I told George and other people there about how I did night vision goggles and how you could see them, and that there's a battle going on up there, and that sometimes you can see it, not always, but you can always see on a good night, you can see craft. And it turned out that I got to talk with George, and then in a short time we met at another thing, and I invited him to come up to the roof. I was showing people UFOs up on the roof.
Mm-hmm.
He smiled and he said, "Oh, I'll come up in a little while." And we were up there, and he didn't show up, so I sent somebody down, and they were seeing a lot of stuff, and they grabbed him and brought him upstairs, and I got to blow his mind and show him UFOs flying, and I showed him one that had stopped, cloaked, and then 20 minutes later, lit up and took off again from the same place. So he now was a believer in what you could do with night vision goggles.
Mm-hmm.
For a while, I think he thought I was a little bit crazy telling him he'd go outside and see him with me.
Well, I got to tell you, too, Ed, you know, at first I was a little bit skeptical of exactly what was being reported, because a lot of the people that were coming forward who had said that they had participated with you at some of the various locations, specifically this Little League baseball field in Calistoga, California, some of the reports that I was hearing just sounded a little bit too active for my liking. And it wasn't until I went out about a year ago to Calistoga, California with you. Bob Oliver was there, Lorian Fenton from Marin Sonoma MUFON, and Rick Prestel from Sacramento MUFON. That evening, I have to tell you, audience, what I saw and what everybody saw through these third and fourth generation night vision binoculars and goggles, just unbelievable quality, the technical level of these goggles, it was amazing. We saw things that were obviously not terrestrial aircraft. We also witnessed events in the sky that there's just no way that these were satellites or any type of aircraft that was created by a human. This definitely appeared to be something off-world, at least technology that was off-world, whether or not it was given to us. We saw some amazing stuff that night. Ed, I want to thank you for taking us out there, because we definitely experienced.
It was totally my pleasure, because when people have doubts and you get a good night out there and you can show them three or four flying together or turning a big circle and going off in another direction or stopping in mid-flight 200 miles up and then staying there for an hour and then starting out and taking off again. And it's just totally amazing. I think that was the one night of one of the, I call it the big experiences. I think we had one craft come over us that
lit up.
This big booming, and it was likely 700-800 feet across. And
yes, that and was the night. We estimated that the craft had to have been about 700 feet wide by 1,400 feet lengthwise. This thing was massive in size, and it what it did was, folks, is that it was moving across the sky, and it literally hovered above where we were. And it stayed there, and everybody was just in amazement over the fact that it stayed in place. But then it lit up. I mean, it like a light show, before taking off in the reverse direction, which is amazing. It was an amazing event.
Yeah, it was coming across the sky, and we got everybody looking at it and attention on it, and one of the people was filming it. William Rowling was filming it, and in turn, is there speaking going on?
It's okay, Ed. I think that somebody from the panel has us turned on their speakers, and we're picking up a little bit of a delay. But William Rowling was there that night, and William is a guy who's going to be coming to the event. He's not going to be speaking, but he's going to be coming with Bob Oliver, and William has a fantastic YouTube site whereby he documents, he records through the night vision goggles many of these witnessed events, and he puts them on YouTube. And I got to tell you, folks, look up William Rowling on YouTube. We'll have a link later on in the chat room for William's YouTube site. But if you're online now and you're surfing, look up William Rowling, and you'll see some amazing videos, many of these are which are captured over the gorgeous night sky of Calistoga, California. And if you're not familiar with the Calistoga area, it's right smack dab in the middle of the Napa Valley. It's between Sonoma and Napa, California, which is just probably one of the most beautiful spots in the country. So, yeah, Ed, thank you very much for that experience.
Yeah, Bill Rowling does a lot of filming down in Santa Cruz area, too.
Another beautiful area of California. Yeah, Santa Cruz is just amazing. Yeah. One of the things I like about Calistoga, which amazed me, was when we got there that evening, there's very little light pollution. You know, despite the town being right there at night, you know, 9 o'clock, 10 o'clock at night, I mean, you just have a beautiful view of the night sky, and the stars are out. And what amazed me, too, Ed, is we know when we're looking at a satellite. We can tell what's a satellite and what's not a satellite. And for that matter, many commercial airline aircrafts were flying, you know, by, you know, and we could tell. We knew what was a satellite. We knew what was an airplane.
Once you see one thing and see the other thing, there's no problem with telling which is which. And you'll even see a few birds come by and a bat or two, and you know, that you can see them so well. And I have taken regular night vision and looked for special colors of tubes and tints and character in tubes. You might get one out of a thousand, and I go through the tubes, and I make these a UFO Skywatch goggle. That's my design. And you can see better than the regular night vision because of the color effects. And so I've been selling these goggles now for a while, and I try to get people as good a price as I can. And you know, instead of like a $3,400 pair of goggles, I try to get it down for $29 or so. And then I test goggles to see what can work and what doesn't work. And people, I tell them about ones that cost less price that can work a little, but not as good.
I got a question for you, and I hate to interrupt you. It's just that we're kind of short on time, and I really want to get to an important question. When a lot of people found out that you were going to be on the show tonight, you know, almost all of them were excited. There were a couple people, though, who were concerned, and they wanted to know if you could enlighten them on the controversy that occurred between you and George Knapp. What was that all about, and has that been resolved, you know, since you've convinced George Norrie about what exactly you're seeing in the sky? Give us a little bit of info behind the whole controversy with George Knapp.
Well, there was just a show that was on, and George was speaker, and George Knapp was on the panel. And Bob Oliver stood up and mentioned that you could see almost any night UFOs flying with night vision goggles. And George Knapp said he didn't believe that. And then I stood up and said, well, it was true, and you're not going to see. But I've never been skunked. And George Knapp said he couldn't believe that. And George Norrie said, well, he believed it, and that it was a fact that every time he's been around or heard about it, that people have seen him. And every time I've taken him out, it's been seen.
Fantastic. And thank you. Thank you for that, Ed.
Yeah,
you know,
that was about it. And, you know, we all do our own work, and we do it in different ways.
Well, that pretty much puts that to rest with George Norrie, vouching on your behalf, George Norrie of Coast to Coast AM, who works with George Knapp, that pretty much puts that to rest, I believe. I mean, I'm going to vouch for you. I was there, and I saw it. Many of us saw it. Rick Prestel from MUFON. But again, Ed, thank you so much for being my first guest tonight. Please hang on for the panel that's going to be coming up in about 40 to 50 minutes. If you could just please hang on. What I need to do now is I need to transition over to my next guest for this evening, which is Lyle Blackburn. Lyle is the author of The Beast of Boggy Creek, The True Story of the Falk Monster, a book with its origins in Falk, Arkansas, and which focuses on a large, hairy, man-like creature said to haunt the vast sulfur river bottoms along the secluded waterway known as Boggy Creek. And many of you will recall that many, many years ago, I don't want to say how many because then you'll know how old I am, when I was a kid, there was a famous movie called The Legend of Boggy Creek, and this has a lot to do with it, not everything. Lyle is probably the world's foremost expert on the Falk Monster, and he's here tonight with us, and he will be at SAC UFO Con this June in Sacramento, California. So, Lyle, welcome to the show.
Hey, thanks for having me.
Yeah, why don't you begin by telling us about the reasons behind your writing this fantastic book?
Well, you know, the Legend of Boggy Creek movie has been very influential to a lot of cryptozoologists over the years. Of course, it was a popular movie back in the 70s, but I think a lot of people who have been interested in Sasquatch and the Bigfoot phenomenon are familiar with the movie. But there's never been a book really written on that, and as I was doing some writing for Rue Morgue magazine, I do a cryptozoology column called Monstro Bizarro, and I thought, man, you know, I've always loved that movie. I've just been fascinated with the creature because I live in Texas, which is about 3 hours from Falk, Arkansas.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, the tagline for the movie was a true story. And I thought, man, what really was the true elements of that, what were made for the movie? And so I just started researching the subject, and I found that, you know, I kind of had the impression, oh, that kind of happened in the 1970s, you know, but what I found was that there was a whole lot more to the story than just what happened in the 70s, and in fact, sightings of the creature have continued on up until today, and I found that some of those were even more amazing than the ones that were covered in the movie. So that just kind of blossomed, my research just blossomed into the book.
Wow. Thank you. One of the questions that I get a lot when I tell people that you're going to be appearing at SAC UFO Con, and they're like, Lyle Blackburn, that's the guy, you know, that's the guy who does this, the Falk Monster, because you're quite known throughout the cryptozoology circle, and including the paranormal circles. A lot of people, though, from the UFO, you know, alien community, they're just learning about you, and a lot of them are very excited about, you know, getting to meet you and hear this whole aspect, because you got to understand that the whole UFO ET community overlaps into the paranormal and, you know, and cryptozoology fields. I mean, it's everything that's pretty much discussed on this show, Jared Pippin's show, Coast to Coast AM, all these great shows, you know. We see that there's this convergence of disciplines, and everybody, you know, eventually meets everybody. And so a lot of people are excited. But one of the questions that I get for you is they want to know, is this a relative of the Sasquatch?
Well, you know, I think I would group it in that category. You know, the reports of the creature and the descriptions are fairly similar, but it's somewhat like the skunk ape. And the skunk ape is a creature that's known to live in Florida, maybe Louisiana. And to me, the creatures have a lot of similarities, but possible differences. So I kind of see it as something between a skunk ape and a Bigfoot. You know, it could be, you know, the creature could be related to the species, but it could have some differences because, you know, when you think about Sasquatch in general, you kind of think of the Pacific Northwest, the kind of big, bulky Bigfoot creature. But this creature, because it lives in the South, it lives in the swamps, you know, it's got to have some adaptations that would allow it to live in the more humid environments and that sort of thing. So, you know, I kind of think it's a relative, but I don't necessarily think it's the exact same, you know, species.
Mm-hmm. And do you think that that's the case because of the more violent reports, you know, from the Beast of Boggy Creek, as opposed to the less, you know, or the nonviolent reports as reported from Sasquatch.
Well, yeah, and it's funny the trend that you see with that, that it's kind of got a reputation for being much, much more dangerous, and, mm-hmm. and that's also kind of transitions into the, you know, making it a great subject for a movie. But, you know, I've got as many reports that just, you know, show the typical Sasquatch thing. People get a glimpse of it. You know, it's reclusive. It's mm-hmm. elusive. It disappears into the darkness. So it's not such a case that it's, mm-hmm. You know, out for blood every time it sees a human, you know.
Wow. And what are the possibilities that the Beast of Boggy Creek is an interdimensional beast? Like much of what's reported out of Skinwalker Ranch, a lot of the Native Americans have legends there saying that there's this portal, this interdimensional portal, that these beasts, you know, they come into our realm and then they leave after a while. Is there any possibility that you think this could be an interdimensional being?
Well, you know, I mean, that's a good question to raise with the whole Bigfoot phenomenon as mm-hmm. a whole. Personally, I just kind of start at the ground level. I say, until we have proof otherwise, let's just mm-hmm. treat it like, you know, an animal with a solid form, and let's go after that. If, you know, if we can find some other proof that it's, you know, it's obviously got some higher intelligence or something which allows it to stay elusive. But, mm-hmm. you know, for me, I just kind of start, you know, I grew up as a hunter in Texas, and I kind of approach the tracking of these animals in the same way, you know, as if I was hunting hogs or deer or anything else, just gives me a kind of a basis, a ground level to start. But I don't really have any reports that, you know, portray it as anything other than an animal.
Sure. And that's amazing. I think one of the things that people are going to be very excited about is to hear or to witness you meeting Jeffrey Gonzalez at this year's SAC UFO Con. Jeffrey is well known here in the California area for his work on Bigfoot. And Jeff has already told me in private discussions that he's really looking forward to meeting you and has lots of questions for you. Jeff recently had an encounter several months back, actually, whereby they believe a baby Sasquatch pressed its face up against a truck. There's lots of evidence, you know, supporting this theory that it wasn't a bear, that it was something else. And they have a biological tissue that was collected. The Fresno Police Department actually came out, dismantled the truck, removed the door carefully. And I just received word from Jeff a week ago that they have managed to collect $15,000 to have Brigham Young University perform some type of a genetic forensic you know, analysis of this vehicle and some of the biological tissues that they had collected. So, again, we're going to have a lot of crypto experts at the event this year. So we're excited to have you, Lyle. Thank you for being my guest tonight. And hang on for a little bit if you can, because we're going to bring you back on the panel. What I need to do now, I need to transition over to my next guest, which is David Wedley. So thank you, Lyle. Thank you very much.
Oh, you bet. I'm excited to be out and join the event.
Awesome. So David Wedley is my next guest tonight. He's the author of The Black Eyed Children. David, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me, Anthony.
Absolutely. David, why don't you tell us a little bit about the lecture you gave in Santa Paula, California a few weeks ago on the tulpas.
Tulpas are basically a collected energy that can take physical. So mm-hmm. in ancient Tibetan traditions, the idea was that through a series of meditations and focused energy, a mental collection of energy could become physically formed. So it was a process where it would look like a ghost or a spirit, and eventually it would become more solidified.
Wow.
Until it became fully formed in the physical realm.
Well, you know, I was there in the audience that day in Santa Paula when you were giving the lecture at Ghost Town, which was the event that was put on by Bill Murphy and his wife, Anita. And, you know, I got to tell you, it was an amazing lecture. What I found most interesting is that from your lecture, what it showed me was not just how powerful the human mind is at manifesting these entities out of pure thought, but that it somehow shows that it could possibly have this, you know, connection to frequencies that resonate and manipulate the human mind. We know that the mind is affected by frequency manipulation. You know, that goes all the way back to Wilhelm Reich and whatnot. But your lecture kind of put the pieces together for a lot of us who looked into, you know, HARP, Project Bluebeam. It was just amazing. It was just amazing, and I want to give you kudos for that. And I'm so excited that you're going to be giving that same lecture to the attendees of SAC UFOCon. How do you feel about, you know, a lot of the emerging rumors that are coming about that there's technologies that exist whereby these systems are in place, you know, these technological systems are in place to send out frequencies to, you know, like these exotic metals, you know, that are possibly, you know, not even, you know, earth-based metals. You know, these are they operate in the biomimetic principle that by through these frequencies they can, you know, change their shape and perform certain functions. You know, do you see a connection to that and the human mind's ability to manipulate frequency and manifest these entities?
Oh, sure. Now, I haven't looked into the technical aspects a lot when it comes to some of the emerging technology of the mind being able to control mechanical devices. But basically, it's the same principles. I mean, if we go back to these ancient shamanic cultures, really, we can transfer a lot of what they were doing into current technology and start to understand what these people knew for thousands of years. And, you know, it's a very basic principle that our minds create energy. And that's something that virtually all ancient cultures have talked about for, you know, hundreds of years. So what we're seeing now is an emergence of applying these ancient traditions and ideas into technological concepts. So it doesn't surprise me at all that that's starting to emerge.
Yeah, you know, recently my 14-year-old son had asked me about psychokinetic abilities, telekinesis, and, you know, a friend of mine had recommended a book that I buy for him by an author by the name of Herbie Brennan. And I bought several books from Herbie Brennan, and one of the books that came in was a ghost hunting book that I had actually picked up for my younger son, my 12-year-old son. He was interested in ghost hunting with me because, you know, a lot of people don't know this, but I actually have a group that's called Umbra Paranormal. If you go to umbraparanormal.com, you can find out what that group is about. That's a ghost team that essentially I work with on the weekends, in addition to the UFO research that I do. But when I was reading this book with my son, there's a section in there, and you got to keep in mind that this book was written for more of a teenage audience. There's a section in there called How to Make a Real Ghost. And Herbie Brennan, essentially, just briefly, there's just three so short paragraphs, but he delves into the distinguished French academic and traveler who you spoke about in your lecture, Madame Alexandra David Neal. And he talked about, you know, how she had manifested through her the teachings that she received there in Tibet, this monk. And I thought that was just the most amazing aspect of your lecture. Because, I mean, unlike this book, your lecture really gave overview of Alexandra David Neal and the work that she did. And, again, it was just something that was very exciting for the audience that day, because I could tell you at least 90% of that audience had never heard of the term tulpa, let alone the fact that humans had this ability to manifest entities out of pure thought. So thank you so much for that lecture, and I can't wait to hear it again up here in Northern California in June.
Oh, yeah, and it's interesting because Alexandra Neal, her story, first of all, she was a phenomenal woman, and it's surprising how few people know about her. She traveled the world. She went into Tibet when it was essentially the Forbidden Kingdom. Westerners weren't even allowed in the country, let alone a Western woman. So the things that she did were just amazing. And she did have a very intense experience where she first of all, she encountered what she was told were tulpas, and through encountering that tulpa, she went to the Brahmins and learned exactly what these beings were, and then she proceeded to learn the Brahmins to create one. That's a pretty amazing story.
Wow. Wow, that's amazing. I can't wait to hear that again. Hey, David, thank you so much for being our guest tonight. If you could please hold on a little bit for the panel that's going to be coming up shortly. What I need to do now is I need to transition into our next guest. So thank you, David. I thank you very much for being on the show with us tonight.
Sure. Thanks,
Andy. Yep. Okay, so let's go ahead and transition into our next guest, probably the best-looking guest of tonight. Just kidding, I'm just going to... Scotty Roberts. Scotty is the co-founder and publisher of Intrepid Magazine, a publication with an eclectic focus on science, politics, culture, ancient civilizations, UFOs and aliens, conspiracies, and unexplained phenomena, and we might as well add underwater basket weaving. Scotty is the former editor-in-chief of Taps Para Magazine, which is the official publication of Sci-Fi's Ghost Hunters television show, this highly rated television show. Scotty, welcome to the show.
Thanks, Anthony. And hey, you don't know the untapped market for underwater basket weaving.
Well, I realized that, you know, Intrepid Magazine, unlike most magazines, covers a lot. So I just wanted to get that in there. But, Scotty, you know, a lot of people are excited about your new book, The Rise and Fall of the Nephilim. And, you know, recently you were on Coast to Coast AM with George Norrie. And I got to tell you, that was probably, it will have to be one of the highest rated shows of the year. I got so many emails because you had mentioned me on the show, and I kept getting these emails. I'm like, what the hell is all this about? And it was you. Everybody was saying, wow, you know, Scotty just did a phenomenal job. You know, he went out of his way to really explain to the listener in layman's terms a lot of these highbrow, you know, theological terms that just most of us, including myself, just don't really get, you know, when we're looking at it from an academic perspective. So thank you for that. And what I'd like to do is I'd like to delve into Genesis a little bit with you, and just to get sure. a brief feedback from you on a couple of questions I have. In Genesis 6, 1 through 4, it says that the sons of God, or we know, you know, from the just from the short contextual, you know, right up that's there, it says that the sons of God are captivated by the beauty of the daughters of men. And we learned that these sons of God, they marry them, they have sex with them, producing offspring, which are giants known as the Nephilim. And Genesis also goes on to say that these Nephilim were mighty men, they were men of renown. You know, these are some terms that I was hoping that you could fill in for us, the gaps, you know, some of us don't understand the meaning of those. What do they mean by mighty men and men of renown?
Sure. Well, first thing I want to say about this is the interesting thing I found is I went to the theological study first because that was my background. But in studying, as many people who've studied any of these things know, you've got over 600 different ancient tribal cultures and religions that mention these types of beings connected to major flood accounts of ancient days and common threads to all of them. One of the most common threads being some sort of non-human or spirit entity intermingling with the, I don't know, I was restricted to just the daughters of men, but the daughters of men, and bequeathing a race that some higher power or some deity needed mm-hmm. to destroy by way of a flood. And that's the basis of the story. If it were just found in Genesis alone, you could go, that's just a Hebrew legend. Mm-hmm. But the Hebrew book of Genesis is really simply another version of this story that's found in many, many, many different places.
Sure.
The sons of God in the Hebrew, known as the Bene HaElohim, they are the ones who descended down, it says in the book of Genesis, and intermingled with the daughters of Adam in the Hebrew. Again, a stark mm-hmm. contrast made. I remember when I was in seminary back many, many years ago, again, you talked mm-hmm. about being dated in your age. Mm-hmm. This would have been back when there was still black and white TV. Not quite that far back. But my seminary professors, some of them, because I was in a very conservative fundamentalist setting, would tell me, oh, well, you know, that's just the sons of the men who ran the schools of the prophets up on the hillside, and they'd come down into the valley and intermingle with the common folk mm-hmm. and had children by them. I said, well, then why is there a stark contrast made in the Hebrew in that in the context there? Why are they the sons or the Bene Elohim versus the daughters of Adam? Why weren't they both called children of Adam and then spelled out a different way? So that's your first clue that something's going on there.
Okay, so I ask you this then, Scotty. So sons of God, daughters of men, what sort of beings were these? Were they human, or did they belong to an alien species of off-world origins? Is that a possibility, the sons of God?
That they were off-world origins? Yeah, I distinctly think they were. I believe they were. When I say that the book of Genesis, now, mind you, I come out of that theology. That's where I was for many years of my life. So when I say this, I'm not saying it lightly. I believe the Hebrew version in the book of Genesis is simply that. It is a version of this story. And you find this story in many different cultures and many different religions. I like to quote, because it's a favorite of mine, because I'm a Welsh Scotsman, I like to quote the Celtic version as a great example of this. The Tuatha De Danann, or the children of the goddess Danu. They were known as the bright, shining kings who descended from heaven and intermingled with humans and also brought forbidden knowledges, which reflects many of the stories that are out there. And and once again, you've got these, they're known as bright and shining. Many references in the Old Testament, the Book of Enoch, as to the bright, shining characters who came down and impregnated human women. Enoch refers to them as the Watchers. Were they off-world? You got as much proof as that these were off-world aliens or extraterrestrials as you do that they were just God-breathed angels or something like that. That's the problem with any of this. There's no real hardcore proof. The proof that I go by is you can apply some modicum of the scientific method to this by saying there was a multiplicity of cultures that told the same stories in common threads with different characters, differing events, but they said the same thing. That creates that sort of scientific methodology that can be applied to all of this, is that it's there, it's anthropological, it's archaeological, it's historical.
And that's what I refer to in my book, UFO Highway, and the human origin section, as that strong lineal traditional connection.
Yes.
One of the things that I wanted to ask you about, when I was writing UFO Highway, when I was delving into the human origin aspect, I was thinking about that whole, you know, aspect of the, you know, between the, you know, this union between the sons of God and the daughters of men. And I remember coming across this writing from Philastrius, who was the bishop of Brescia. He had wrote a catalog of heresies, and one of the ideas that he said that was ludicrous, and in fact he said would have been impossible, was that how when you interpret that the sons of God as these fallen angels were enticed by these beautiful women of earth and began lusting after them, the literal wording of the Bible, you know, considering the fact that these were angelics, people like Philastrius of that time considered these angelics to be non-physical beings and therefore could not have engaged in sexual relationships with women from earth. Is that right?
That's where I think he went wrong in the first place, and many people went wrong, is that the Hebrew word for angel never exists in any of these texts.
They're not
called that at all. But you go to Psalm 82, and I know you've got to jump off of me here pretty soon and on to somebody else, but let me throw this in. Psalm 82, read that. It talks about a group known as the Divine Council and Elohim, the God among many gods, referring to them as gods in heaven. So, by the way, if you want to get controversial about it, the Bible doesn't teach monotheism. If you go back to the original languages in which it's written and look at the
very
context.
Very much polytheism, that's right.
Right, and they are called the bright, shining princes of heaven.
Wow.
Just like the Celts called the Tuatha, the bright, shining kings from heaven. And they weren't writing the book of Genesis. They were writing from a Celtic angle. So these similar beings existed, and you're not going to find the word angel existing anywhere. So they weren't spirit beings in that sense. They were corporeal in form.
Wow. Hey, Scotty, thank you so much for that. You know, that's a lot of information in a little bit of time, but I know that the audience got a lot. So thank you for being on the show. And listen, hang in there for a few minutes. We have to transition over to Micah Hanks. And, again, so thank you, Scotty. And
Micah Hanks?
Yes, Micah Hanks.
Micah Hanks, bring him on. The one, the only, the Micah, the Hanks.
Okay, so hang in there, Scotty. We'll be back in a few minutes for the panel. And okay, so my next guest is Micah Hanks, who is a full-time journalist, a radio personality, a musician, an author, and investigator of the unexplained. Throughout his many years studying the world's mysteries, Hanks has visited a number of places collecting information about not only aliens and UFOs, but also cultural data, folklore, and reports of strange creatures like Sasquatch. He also spent a number of years working with various scientists, historians, and film crews, particularly fellow researcher and friend Joshua P. Warren, who many of you know, attempting to solve the mystery of the Brown Mountain Lights. Hanks has been featured as a guest on many television and radio programs, including the History Channel's Guts and Bolts show, Travel Channel's Weird Travels, CNN Radio, and the Jeff Rentz program. He is also a staff writer for UFO Magazine, Mysterious Universe, and a regular contributor to Intrepid Magazine. That's our friend Scotty Roberts' magazine. So again, I'd like to welcome Micah Hanks. Micah, welcome to the show.
Well, thank you so much, Anthony. It's my pleasure to be here with you tonight. And, you know, as a matter of fact, I might as well go ahead and just put this out there. You know, Scotty and I, we work very closely together. I'm actually operating in an editorial function with Intrepid Magazine these days. So, you know, I've been promoted. And I tell you, there's nobody in the world to save maybe yourself that I'd like to work that closely with. Scotty is absolutely fantastic. And, you know, I also just have to say, man, how do you follow somebody like him?
Yeah, Scotty's a one of a kind. Hey, listen, Micah, why don't you tell our audience about Magic, Mysticism, and the Molecule? That's just a fantastic book, and I want to see if you could briefly tell the audience what it encompasses.
Well, yeah, sure. And for me, doing anything briefly is very difficult because, as I'm known, at least throughout my region and among my own listenership of my program, the Graylian Report, I am the mouth of the South. No matter what Ted Turner may say, I am indeed the man who's laid claim to the title. That said, to try and condense this concept into the most important criteria, Magic, Mysticism, and the Molecule is a study of what happens when human beings enter altered states of consciousness. And there are three general varieties that I discuss in that book, which are, of course, magical practices and ritual, mystical processes, meditation, things like that, and then also the kind of induced reaction that we have to hallucinogenic substances and entheogens. Those three things comprise the content in Magic, Mysticism, and the Molecule, and unlike a lot of researchers, I'm not putting all these together to try and create what you might call a grand unified theory that unites all paranormal phenomena or the unexplained. I don't think that we have all the answers, and that in terms of what human perception will allow, that we will ever really have all those answers, at least in this life. But I'll tell you this, that I think that there are indeed certain connections and parallels that can be drawn, and I approach it, as you kind of said in the introduction, primarily as, you know, a folklorist or as a philosopher from that perspective. Again, I'm not someone who's going to tell you that that all these strange phenomena that we experience in this life, all these strange experiences that we have, are entirely physical or entirely real in the sense of how, you know, humans perceive real physical reality. I think a lot of it is symbolic. I think that there's a lot of subversive things that may mean kind of, you know, or subliminal things, I think would be a better way to describe it, that affect us individually and that they may not have that meaning for others. And so that's just part of the quest that is life, you know, finding that sense of meaning.
Well, Micah, I've been sitting on a question for a long time because I've not met a person who I felt could adequately answer this question, but you, my friend, I think you could be the person that could give me the type of feedback that I'm seeking. When I look at these modern-day musicians like David Blaine and Chris Angel, and I see some of the things that they perform, you know, it makes me wonder, you know, as a skeptic of the whole magical, you know, phenomena, you know, because, you know, I see Penn and Teller. I see, you know, they do these tricks or whatever, and then they show you exactly how they do it. But I'm telling you, there's stuff that David Blaine and Chris Angel do that, for me, you know, when you're talking about magic and mysticism and consciousness, and do you think that it's possible that individuals like that could have possibly tapped into another level of consciousness and this ability to manipulate the physical, and that's what gives them this great ability to perform such you know, tremendous feats? What is your opinion on that?
My opinion on that is that yes and no. I don't think that individuals like David Blaine, for instance, are literally manipulating matter in a way that most people cannot. They are not mutants or magicians in that sense, sorcerers. I think that, obviously what they're doing is a form of showmanship. It's misdirection. To quote John Travolta's character from the film Swordfish, the eyes see, the mind believes. And that is very true, because what the eyes see, the mind believes. I think that we have to take into consideration that a variety of unexplained phenomena witnessed by people and experienced in our lives are probably the result of misinterpretation of known phenomena we observe, and then the mind interprets that, again, in a way that may be symbolic and representative of something on a deeper spiritual level to us as individuals, and therefore we take from that a spiritual or profound experience that some might deem paranormal. Now, that said, we also take for granted what role we as individuals and what role human perception on an individual basis plays in what constitutes our reality. And therefore, if we perceive something as being spiritual, magical, unexplained, or even otherworldly, there is, I think, in a certain capacity on an individual level, whether this be, physical, psychological, or otherwise, there is something that affects us as individuals, and that, in a sense, I think, can have the capacity to actually constitute in some way, shape, or form a version of reality. This especially occurs on the quantum level. When we observe certain particles, especially photons, and they can behave either as, for instance, a waveform or a single particle. So we have a lot of strange little variables, and perception seems to be at the root of it. We don't understand that entirely, but in that sense, yes, I think that human ability to perceive is flawed, and therefore when we perceive certain things, the perception of a mystery alone could constitute that mystery itself.
And within that same vein, much like with David Weatherly talking about this tulpa effect and this ability for humans to literally, channel their powers within their mind and focus hard enough to manifest these entities out of pure thought. That's interesting. Wow, Micah, thank you so much. I hate to cut you off, Micah, but I need to transition into my next guest, Mr. Jay Weiner. So, Micah, thank you so much, and you adequately and aptly answered those questions well enough that such that we understood. But I got to say, Jesus Christ, how many degrees do you have? What kind of doctorates do you have? In you're very well spoken, my man, and you made us understand very succinctly. So thank you, Micah, and we're glad to have you at SAC UFO Con. I know many people are excited. As a matter of fact, I had a couple who bought tickets from England who are excited about meeting you. So that's something I thought I'd share with you.
How awesome. Well, I'm looking forward to being up there, too. And that said, I'll abstain and allow you to go on to the next guest.
All right, and stay put for the panel, which will be happening very shortly after the break. So I'm going to transition into our next and final guest, many of whom you know, Mr. Jay Weidner. Jay is just an amazing individual. I got to tell you, this year I was on a live stream with Carrie Cassidy of Project Camelot, and she had paired me with probably one of the most amazing individuals that I have met in this whole field of the conspiratorial. Wired Magazine has called Jay Weidner an authority on the hermetic and alchemy traditions. Sorry about that. I got tongue-tied. And one of the things that I'd like to first delve into, well, first of all, Jay, welcome to the show.
Hey, thanks for being here.
Yeah, it's great to hear your voice. Many of us know that you're a renowned author, this a fantastic filmmaker, and this hermetic scholar. I have some questions that I had put together for you, Jay. Most people are just now learning about the work that you have done on the archons with respect to the Nag Hammadi codices. I have been going on radio recently, and I've been telling people about your work. And I got to say, number one, there's a huge audience out there that is very familiar with you, especially for the works that you have done in the film industry. Kubrick's Odyssey, it's just an amazing film. You have a new film that's going to be coming out this year called Shasta. Before we delve into the archons, can you tell us a little bit about this new film, Shasta?
Yeah, it's a feature film with real actors and a real story, and I think it's pretty good. And it's a story, actually got started about 30 years ago. I was reading some ancient Vedic texts, and I found a prophecy. And the prophecy said that right near the end of the cycle, the 10th avatar of Vishnu, The Buddha is the ninth avatar, so you know where we're coming from here.
Yes.
The tenth avatar of Vishnu, whose name is Kalki, will come to Earth, and he will destroy the enemies of truth. So for 30 years, I've been waiting for Kalki to come, and he never came. So I decided that I would just make a movie of him coming, and mm-hmm. maybe that would get the whole thing started.
Oh,
so the movie is, it's about the return of Kalki, and, you know, how does Kalki destroy the enemies of truth without resorting to violence? And that was really the trick of the screenplay, I guess.
Wow.
And I think I achieved it. So it'll be out in September, and I think people are going to like it.
I think people are going to love it. You know, when we met, Jay, shortly after we met through Carrie Cassidy, I went out and purchased the Nag Hammadi Scriptures, the revised and updated translation by Marvin Meyer, and the complete sacred Gnostic text. And I have been delving in deeply into these, and specifically the paraphrase of Shem, which I'm sure you're familiar with. There was some really interesting stuff in there. There was this one passage where it said, "The spirit discovers the evil root, and his light becomes entangled with the mind of darkness, the first mind." And then later on it says, "For the spirit made use of every form of darkness, because he had appeared in his greatness." When I think of terms like form of darkness, and when I listen to you tell us about these archons, and to me, it's almost as if the archons have made it such that throughout time, they have carefully architected our society such that by default, we worship them. And I know about the archons, but many of the people listening don't know about the archons. So let alone be hard-pressed to define it, those of us that know what an archon is. Why don't you tell the audience, what is an archon?
Well, now, that's a big question. An archon is, the Nag Hammadi, I'll just tell you what they say. The Nag Hammadi says that they're like us, but they don't have our essence. And they duplicate reality to fool us into doing exactly what you just said, into getting us to, by default, worship them and think that they're our saviors. And by doing that, we give our power to them and make them strong and thereby also make ourselves weak. Now, the thing about the Nag Hammadi, which is so important, is that it was found in clay jars in Egypt in 1945, and nobody's been able to mess with these texts. No popes, no kings, nobody. We have it straight as they wanted us to read it. And they're telling us that the Earth is being invaded by an off-planet species named the Archons, who encourages us into violence and war, and that basically we are their slaves. And that's a pretty shocking thing coming from people 2,000-plus years ago. Mm-hmm. But if you look at the evidence that we see today manifested before us, a lot of the stuff that you, Anthony, have been finding, we can see that this message from 2,100 years ago actually is more credible now than ever. And if you think about it, the real answer to a lot of our problems is that we're actually facing an off-planet entity who's outsmarting us. And that's the outcome.
Yeah, well, thank you very much for that. You know, there's a lot of people behind this message that at the end of 2012 or shortly thereafter, E.T. is coming to save us from ourselves. But, you know, Jay, I got to tell you, because everything I know, especially from the work that I've studied, much like your own, you know, I delved deeply into a lot of the transcripts from conversations that you had with people like Jeff Rentz. You know, it tells me that these archons, they're out to destroy us or enslave us. They're not coming to save us. Am I right?
No, and I think you are right. I'd be very dubious about any aliens coming to save us, and it would be something more like that scene from The Twilight Zone, To Serve Man, where the aliens are coming to kill us and acting like they're coming to save us. And so I'd be very dubious about any of that. I think we're caught in a situation here which is sort of a prison planet, but we can get out. There are recipes for how to get out of the Archon Control, which I'll be addressing at the conference.
Mm-hmm.
And I believe that this Archon problem is the worst problem that we face on Earth right now. We don't even know who we are. We don't
wow.
know what we possess. We don't know how much wealth we really have, because the Archons have been stealing it from us for 3, 4, 5, longer thousands of years than that.
Oh, my
and
goodness.
I think that's, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, one of the things I wanted to ask you, do you feel that it's possible that the Archons not only reside here on Earth, but that they can also occupy the Moon or Mars? And here's the reason why I ask. Because we have evidence of past civilizations on both locations. For instance, there are two critical pieces of compelling evidence where perfectly rectangular upright structures found in images from NASA are on the Moon of Mars in Phobos. These bear a striking resemblance to the monoliths planted on Earth and on the Moon by aliens in the classic sci-fi film 2001: A Space Odyssey.
Yeah.
So you have the monoliths, and then there are the pyramids associated with both Mars and the Moon again. I mean, for instance, in one of the reflections of the Apollo astronaut's visor, I forget which astronaut it is, it clearly shows a pyramid. When you enhance the photo and you look into the visor, you can clearly see that he's staring at a pyramid. And we also know of the D&E pyramid of Cydonia on Mars. But I ask you, do you believe that, you know, much to the effect that the Nag Hammadi says that these Archons are lurking in various planets within our solar system. What do you feel about them lurking on the Moon or in Mars? And after you answer that, we're going to be transitioning out to a break. But go ahead.
Well, I definitely think that they're occupying the Moon and Mars, and a lot more the planets, the moons of Saturn, and a lot more the rings of Saturn. I think we can see occupation vehicles in.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, they're occupying the solar system, and they're trapping us, and they're tapping, they're using us for energy, food, and some kind of soul harvesting.
Well, and I think that it's interesting that a lot of that symbolism played out in Stanley Kubrick's movie 2001: A Space Odyssey, and you're the person, you know, that gave us Kubrick's Odyssey, which is documentary, which showed what? Which showed us the symbolism contained therein, you know, within the work of it, you know, within the man's work. And I think it's not by coincidence that in 2001: A Space Odyssey we see these monoliths, and today we're finding monoliths on both the moons, the Moon of Mars and Mars itself. Hey, Jay, thank you so much for being my guest. Stay put. We're going to transition out to a break, and when we come back, we're going to delve into some other questions as part of a panel where everybody will get to chime in. And I want to remind Scotty, Micah, Lyle, and David, and yourself, Jay, and Ed, feel free to chime in at any time when we come back into the panel. I'll set it up for us, and then we'll go from there. So we're going to go break, everybody. We'll be back in a few minutes.
Hey, friends, this is George Norrie. Don't miss this year's UFO Paranormal Summit in Sacramento, California on June 16th and 17th at the beautiful Crown Plaza Hotel. Come see Stanton Friedman, Project Camelot's Kerry Cassidy, Area 51 legend Norio Hayakawa, Scotty Roberts and Anthony F. Sanchez, critically acclaimed author of the book UFO Highway, and many more of your favorite paranormal and UFO researchers. The UFO Paranormal Summit is bringing together the best minds in paranormal investigative, crypto hunting, and UFO alien hunting fields. For the strange, mysterious, and frightening, nothing will be left unanswered. Happening June 16th and 17th in Sacramento. Go to sacufocon.com, that's sacufocon.com, for more information, or type UFO Paranormal Summit in your very favorite search engine or Facebook, and you can find it that way. sacufocon.com.
Hey, everybody, this is Anthony Sanchez. I'm back with my guest, Ed Grimsley, Lyle Blackburn, David Weatherly, Scotty Roberts, Micah Hanks, and Jay Widener. We're going to now conduct a panel, which, according to my good buddy Jerry Pippin, this is a first for Inception Radio Network. It has not been done. These are gentlemen who are going to be keynote speakers at the SAC UFO Con event. This is the UFO Paranormal Summit. If you were to go onto Google and just type in UFO Paranormal Summit, it's going to take you to sacufocon.com. And this is an event that we're having in Sacramento. It is going to be held at the beautiful Crown Plaza Hotel. There's the images on the website, you know, and again, there's a speakers page which will give you a short bio and links, external links to all of the speakers that are participating in the conference. This is going to be an amazing conference. It's a one-of-a-kind event. I don't think there's ever been a conference like this one. This is the reason why we're calling it a summit, because it is a meeting of the minds. So we're going to have individuals from the paranormal, from the crypto field, and from the UFO alien field. Not to mention, we're having Michelle Menny, who I neglected to mention at the beginning of the show. Michelle Menny is going to be appearing. She's a good friend of mine. I met her through Janet Saylor at the ASPE conference. She was there in 2010, and then I met her again over in 2011. When all this Dulcie stuff happened this past year. She is the founder of Holistic Mountain. She's a holistic practitioner, and she's just a wonderful person. She's from the Chippewa Turtle Mountain clan, and her abilities as an intuitive, as a psychic, and as a storyteller are just going to be a native, for many of the native stories that she regales and tells us of. It's going to be a treat to have her at the conference this year. So, again, Michelle Menny is going to be there. And a correction that I like to make is that when I introduced Micah Hanks earlier, I neglected to mention that he's actually a partner in Intrepid Magazine with Scotty Roberts, and the two of them do an outstanding job, and they have some of the most prolific contributors out there in all of the fields that I just mentioned. And I think that if you were to pick up a copy of Intrepid Magazine, which is an online magazine, you would see that I'm correct. Again, so why don't we go ahead and begin the panel? What I'd like to do is remind each of our guests that you have the ability to jump in at any time. I'm going to moderate, so if I feel that somebody is on point, I'm going to let them have a little bit extra time, and then I'm going to allow everyone else to chime in. So I'm going to pose a question for each of the individuals and start it off. What I'm going to do is I'm going to ask Ed Grimsley first. Ed, and by the way, after I ask Ed the question, Scotty, Micah, Lyle, and David, and Jay, you guys are welcome to jump in and add to it. So, Ed, I want to start off by asking you a question. We know that you do a lot of work. You do a lot of work with your sky watches using these second, third, and fourth generation, night vision goggles. These are like $4,000 binoculars. I remember holding them that evening and using them. It was just amazing what we were seeing. There's a lot of speculation that a lot of the ships that we're seeing are Anunnaki or gray ships. But I wanted to ask you about Planet X, also known as Nibiru. Many people are speculating that it is coming our way, possibly even entering into our atmosphere. Some people speculated that it'll hit Earth. Some people speculate that it's actually a big spaceship. What is your opinion on Planet X or Nibiru, Ed Grimsley?
Well, I think it is a good possibility that some of this life form that we see zooming around in some of the ships up there now may be part of it.
Mm-hmm.
And also that our government may have technology and some of the craft that's been back engineered and done to maybe fight off Nibiru. And maybe there's going to be a lot of battling going on, and maybe not. Maybe they're going to join forces, but I think the human race, no matter what they do, is in trouble. Because I don't think any of them are coming here to give us a dessert and a pie and super knowledge. I think they're coming here to take.
Mm-hmm.
And if you've ever had the government or anyone else say, hey, let me be your friend, do you not watch your back end? And you have to watch in all directions these things that are going on,
mm-hmm.
because some of it I think is very true. Some of it I think is very stretched out. And it may even be that there's some fear factors being used to scare the hell out of us.
Sure.
And some truth. And so we have to use our heads to find out what is the truth, what is the fear, and what do we need to prepare for. And it's so scary that when things happen that your own president
mm-hmm.
and your own Congress and your own Senate, I think 7 of them voted against it, but the rest of them went for, we can't own a garden, we can't grow our own food, and that we can't have over a week's supply. And so when they do that, it means those people that are supposed to be working for us are actually working against us.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know how many of them are high breeds or low breeds or no breeds, but I don't trust any of them.
Got it.
Maybe wrong.
Excellent response. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you, Ed. Let me do this. Jay, are you with us?
Yes.
Let me throw this at you, Jay. When you hear someone like Ed who has this, this vast amount of experience with this technology whereby he looks up into the sky and he has proven to literally thousands of people that something otherworldly is occurring above us in our own skies. And then you have a conspiracy theorist out there who are delving into ancient religious texts. They're delving into the work of Zachariah Sitchin, and they're espousing this idea of Planet X or Nibiru. Do you believe that there is a connection to what we know about the Archons, whom I call the progenitors, and who many people believe are descendants of the Anunnaki? I mean, again, I'm working on a parallel study trying to show the connection, for instance, the fact that the descendants of the Anunnaki, also known as reptilians by some people, are Archons by some, that they all have one thing in common is that they despise humanity, and that they have set it up such that we worship them, giving them what they need to feed off of, war and poverty, and famine. So when you hear about a theory like Nibiru, Planet X, does that resonate at all for you, or do you think that's a bunch of bullshit?
Well, I don't know. I think it could be true. I haven't really looked into it. I have read Sitchin's stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And one of my really good friends is a firm believer in it, so that caused me to maybe step back a little bit and maybe think that it might be true. But,
mm-hmm.
I did meet Ed and I have met, and his night vision goggles were so impressive to me that I went out and I bought a pair from Ed.
Yeah.
And it's one of my favorite hobbies is going out at night around twilight and looking at all of the strange objects that are flying around in the sky. And I'm sure some of it is ours, the military.
Absolutely.
But some of it is so wild and crazy and moving at such zigzag patterns and things that there's mm-hmm. no way. And do I think it's the... bad guys? Well, I'll tell you this, and Ed can confirm this. Somebody's up there, and they're fighting with each other. That's all I can tell you. They're
mm-hmm.
like they're shooting at each other. They're jockeying against each other. And I'll be danged if I can tell you any more than that. It's just you show it to people, and when they
uh-huh.
see it, then they're amazed, too. So there's a lot more going on above our heads than we know. And we should say, and maybe Ed's already said it, that,
mm-hmm.
These things that we're seeing, you cannot see them with the naked eye. You can only see them through the night vision goggles.
Wow, that's amazing. So, let me ask you this: do you think that if this is a if there is something coming our way that it could possibly be artificial, like a planetoid that's like artificially constructed that's going to affect us, that could be inhabited by these archons. And we know through the Nag Hammadi that these archons, they lurk among the planets within our own solar system. And there's evidence showing that there's something on Mars, something on the moon that's very eerily reminiscent of what we have here on Earth, i.e. these monoliths and these pyramids. So is it too far-fetched to believe that this Planet X theory can be true? I mean, I personally think there is some validity to it. But, you know, you carry a lot more weight than I do, and I would love to have your opinion.
I don't know.
And it's okay. And if you don't know, it's okay. It's okay if you don't know. All right. So with that, let us jump over to another question.
Can I say one thing before we jump?
Yes, go for it.
Okay, there is definitely members of our government, military complex, Nazi influenced.
Like Operation Paperclip, you're referring to Paperclip?
Could be. We know that there is battling going on up there. But I don't know to what extent we are taking place in it. It might be few sources, are they battling over us and our control, or are they battling against principles, good, evil, whatever, and are they summoning our help on one side or the other, and are we how involved? And the fact that our elite government is lying to us to cover up the fact that that is taking place and going on tells me that they have been taken over by one of those forces.
Possibly alluding to the New World Order and the fact that they have set things up for us, and we're just simply bearing witness to events that are now in place, like these execution phases of certain things. And that leads me into my next question, which is for Scotty Roberts. Scotty, you're familiar with HAARP, which is the High Frequency Active Auroral Research Program out of Gakona, Alaska. Everybody's familiar with HAARP.
I'm familiar with it, but I couldn't tell you a damn thing about it in detail.
Hold on. Wait a minute. Let me get to my question. Okay, so one of the things that a lot of us theorists who know about, you know, I have an engineering background. I know about HAARP. I understand the technical aspect of HAARP. But there's this potential for this dangerous religious aspect to HAARP, and I think that's where you can help us. A lot of people believe that HAARP is being used to create earthquakes, to manipulate the weather, and for purposes of mind control. Norio Hayakawa tells us about Project Bluebeam, which is this whole project that was conceived within the darkest depths of our government at NASA, no less, to control certain populaces by manipulating, one, their mind utilizing frequencies, but also through the visual aspect, which is where I come to you. One of the things that I found through my own research on HAARP is that they literally can heat up the ionosphere such that they can create a temporary movie screen that's literally a plasma field, a plasma screen, which they can project 3D holographic imagery upon. Think about this, Scotty.
Okay.
Many people are saying that in the Middle East, they will project images that are right out of the Torah or the Bible or the Quran. Some people are saying that here in the Western world, they are going to project images that allude to this false flag event of this UFO invasion. And when you look at the conditioning of the populaces around the globe, on the Western world, we've been conditioned since the 1950s to accept the fact that UFOs and aliens are real and that this could be something that, you know, is going to happen one day, you know, with movies like Battlefield Los Angeles, Independence Day. But over in the Middle East, where you have cultures much like the Muslim culture, which, you know, they adhere to a lot of these religions that are like, you know, a lot of these traditions which are 800 years old, and they do not veer away from them. Do you think that it's possible that we would utilize, not we, I mean the government or the military-industrial complex would utilize that type of technology to fool these people into believing that something of a religious nature, you know, something profound is happening to stir up emotions, to cause, you know, chaos, you know, anarchy?
Let me just throw in there. The first thing that I think, and I don't mean to be as flippant as this sounds, somebody's going to be standing there watching that and going, man, that is so Photoshopped.
Yeah.
You know, I think that all these grand conspiracies that are out there, I can't be the one to say some of those things don't exist. When you talk about Nibiru and you talk about all of this stuff, I think Sitchin, I would say, he might have been onto something there. But do I believe he had a corner on what it really is? I don't know, and I don't think so.
Uh-huh.
I think there was a little too much tampering or squeezing of the ancient language to make it work and to make it factual. And I think that's what you've got with all this stuff with HARP and anything else like this.
Mm-hmm.
You can say, you know, theoretically, it has the capability of doing this.
Yeah.
But there are lots of theoreticals out there. Theoretically, I could beam my two chihuahuas from here to Pluto, mm-hmm. but I just don't have the technology to pull it off. Is it going to work? Probably not. I think, however, you're onto something too when you say masses are there to be duped. And I think if somebody wants to project a big picture on the sky over in the Middle East and go, oh, look, it's the seventh trumpet,
mm-hmm.
You know, good luck. You know, I don't think it's going to work. That's my personal opinion. I'm only speaking from a opinion on this because there's no way to know.
What you're saying is that if Zachariah, and a lot of people are in agreement with you, they do believe that Zachariah Sitchin's interpretations of the cuneiform and the cylinder seals, all these translations, his own interpretations, and they veer away from what some experts in academia have said it actually is. And as such, you know, he developed essentially his own gospel, so to speak, on what
he feels
is going to happen. So don't you think, though, that with that occurrence, you know, with what he did, with the result of his work having occurred, and so many people buying into it, don't you think that the government or this military-industrial complex could tap into that as part of some grander picture to utilize as part of a Project Bluebeam? Hey,
well,
we got 9 million people on the West Coast that believe in Zachariah Sitchin, and they're all concentrated in Northern California. What do you think?
Well, Constantine did it in the 300s, didn't he? He latched on to a religious movement to consolidate his empire.
Are you referring to his witnessing of the cross in the sky during a battle?
That amongst many things. But, of course, Constantine, known as the first Christian emperor of Rome, was anything but the first Christian emperor of Rome. He went promptly home after one of the councils murdered his wife and son, and he also was as pagan as the rest of them, using pagan in a negative sense of the word. And he was the poster child for taking last rites and baptism on his deathbed. So he could live the life of debauch he wanted to. All of that aside, I don't think Constantine was Christian at all. I think he used the movement to accomplish something. Now, you asked, would a government do that? Sure, a government would do that. I don't think we're beyond that at all today.
Sure.
Look
sure.
at your extremist Muslims today. They will use anything they can to garner their followers.
Mm-hmm.
And they will twist scriptures. They will twist their own people to accomplish their political ends. I don't think that's anything new in history. Now, as far as Sitchin goes, I don't want to totally dismantle the guy. I don't have the ability to even dismantle everything he said.
Sure.
However, I think that he is somebody who sincerely went out building a theory on something he believed. But that's isn't that kind of like what a lot of crackpots do, too? The world's ending in 19 months. The rapture's coming. And I'm going to go out there and preach that. And that guy probably sincerely believed the rapture was coming when he said that.
Like Harold Camping recently did that, and he essentially spent $65 million of his followers' donation money on telling these people that the world was going to end last year in May and then in October, it didn't happen. And they killed themselves. Some of them killed themselves.
I would have said, hey, dude, bravo with your eschatology there. I will help you. I'm going to be one of the remaining few during the Great Tribulation, but I need some money to spend. Can I have that $65 million, please? But, you know, all of this stuff falls into those realms of watch. Somebody asked me a couple of weeks ago. Here's what I'm trying to say. They asked me about the religions that come out of some of this thinking. And I'm saying once you put religion and dogmatic theology or thinking to something, you've immediately closed off the option for something else. When you create dogmatic religion, you've closed the door to any kind of open-mindedness. So when it becomes a religion, when things like Sitchin's teachings become tantamount to religion, you're creating something where people don't want to see something any differently because this is what they believe now. And so I think there's the danger there. And there's so much in what you ask, there's no way to hit it all, but there you go.
Yeah.
There's
my thank thank you. Let me ask Micah Hanks a question here. Micah, we're talking a little bit about the conspiratorial here, and I wanted to get your opinion. And I know you're coming from, this magic and mysticism, this whole other side. But I know that you just wrote a new book. You're penning a new book right now called The UFO Singularity. Is that the title?
That's correct, yes.
Yeah, first of all, kudos on the title. What one hell of a name for a title. That's a good, it leaves the door open to a lot of cool stuff to discuss. But we're talking about UFOs. We're talking about the possibility of, government intervention and, the possibility of these false flag events. But something that's really occurring across the globe right now is we're seeing this exponential rise in the number of diseases and viruses and antibacterial resistant types of medical whatever. Anyway, I got a question for you. SARS. Many people believe that SARS was introduced as a weapon to depopulate the Earth. Now, I'm not necessarily asking you to focus on SARS in particular, but do you feel, based on some of the work that you've done over the years, and I know that you've covered quite a bit, do you feel that there is a legitimate effort to depopulate the Earth, possibly to some Illuminati organization, or as David Icke calls them, these reptilians, or this New World Order structure, depopulating the Earth? Do you think it's real?
Short answer, no. Severe acute respiratory syndrome is caused by what's known as the coronavirus. We have to be very careful because although I think that there are measures that could be used in population control, perhaps SARS is one of them, there's not a lot of evidence that directly correlates that with, broad-reaching, subversive organizations or operations meant to.
What about AIDS? What about AIDS? Do you feel AIDS was manufactured, or do you think AIDS is a natural occurrence?
I think that it's both in a sense. AIDS obviously is something that probably resulted from humans trying to study the way that certain simian viruses affected various primates, and then of course as a result of that it's quite complex and we couldn't really probably get into all of it right now, but the bottom line is that I think that indeed it's something that occurred naturally but kind of as a byproduct of human interest in studying viruses and the spread of contagious diseases. Now that said, we also may overcome those kinds of things in the coming year. At this point, HIV is already primarily a manageable disease. There are, although they are not affordable yet, there are treatments that have been shown to be effective in actually curing viruses like that. But by the same token, let's look at something that really is actually a manufactured, synthesized virus that could be very dangerous. I don't know if SARS or HIV would qualify, but the H5N1 device, a genetically synthesized version of the super flu that we've seen manifest at various times over the years, bird flu, all this kind of stuff, something along those lines, that truly was created in a laboratory, and that really I think is a potential tremendous threat. And the reason why that's so threatening is because something synthesized like that in the laboratory has a natural immunity, I guess, to a lot of the known vaccines and treatments for that kind of a viral infection. So again, the thing is, and I'm no bacteriologist whatever it is that focuses on that kind of thing. But the truth of the matter is that I think that that is a much far more potentially dangerous disease, especially in terms of the potential for it to wipe people out. Now, is it intentionally designed for that purpose? No, I don't think so. Was it designed in a laboratory in such a way that indeed humans may have inadvertently caused death and destruction? Yes, that's certainly the case. I have to be very careful, and I think we all should, about committing to conspiracy theories. And for the record, this is just my opinion, but I'm going to put it out there. I haven't seen a lot of evidence for these kind of space battles and things that have been mentioned earlier in the discussion as well. That very well may be the case, but again, I like to try and lean on empirical data to back up those sorts of claims. That's just my two cents.
Got it. Okay, great. Thank you so much. So essentially, just to surmise, you're saying AIDS came from shagging monkeys. All right, let me get to my next question, which is for, no, I'm just playing with you, Micah. I don't know if you got that, but anyway, let me get to my next question, which is to my crypto guys, Lyle Blackburn and David Weatherly. A lot of people are talking about this interdimensional portals and the possibility of these beings coming through these portals, some people believing that these are interdimensional beings that represent many of what we believe to be either monsters and in some cases, aliens. What is your opinion on that? Does the chupacabras, does Bigfoot, does the Falco monster? David and Lyle, what do you guys feel about this interdimensional aspect?
Well, this is Lyle. The chupacabra definitely has elements of alien in the descriptions. And, you know, it's odd because in that particular cryptid, it's split into two sort of versions. You have the one that started in the 1990s in Puerto Rico, which is described in a lot of terms with alien features, you know, spikes and wings and you know, a much more outlandish type of creature that you would normally find in the forest. And then, you know, you have a version that they see in Texas, which is essentially what they call a blue dog, and that is a mangy sort of canine or coyote. So same thing for Bigfoot. I mean, you have people that do studies and correlations between UFO sightings and Bigfoot sightings to see if these correspond, and it seems like for every one of these creatures, these theories exist, you know.
Mm-hmm. David Weatherly, are you still with us?
Yeah, I am, and I was just listening to what Lyle was saying.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there's so many factors that we have to consider, too. I mean, if we go back to native cultures, there's a lot of legends about creatures that left this plane of existence, and in some terms, you know, they went through a shimmering doorway, or it's hard not having all the understanding of how they were interpreting what they experienced. I mean, these may be creatures that are living underground for all we know.
Sure.
And I'm not necessarily promoting a hollow earth theory or anything, but, you know, there may be, my God, they just found those massive caves in, I think it was Vietnam, that virtually have a jungle growing in the cave. So I think there are a lot of possibilities for some of these creatures that people are seeing. I mean, it could be some type of camouflage that some of these beings have that we don't completely understand yet. I mean, certainly a chameleon can blend in with its surroundings. Possibly a larger being like a Bigfoot or Sasquatch could have some type of camouflage that allows it to do it, and that would give credence to some of the reports that these things are able to just disappear.
And I wouldn't necessarily, you know, be too quick to disavow the hollow earth theory. And the reason why I say that is because when you mention these caves, like they just recently discovered in Vietnam, or hell, when you even look at the Carlsbad Caverns, or in Chihuahua, Mexico, where they discovered the giant crystal caves, there are parts of this planet which we just don't understand, that we're not aware of, and we will not be aware of for hundreds, if not thousands of years, you know, if we're still here as a species. I remember seeing a movie. God, I don't remember the name of the movie, but I think it was called The Core or something to that effect, where they were drilling through the earth using this drilling device, and they happened upon this massive, you know, cavernous area where it was littered with diamonds, and everyone was like, "Oh, that's such bullshit." The next thing you know, several years later, northern Mexico, Chihuahua, Mexico, these scientists discover what? They discover this massive, you know, half-million-year-old cave with these gigantic formations of these gypsum crystals, which are just amazing. Something that they thought was not possible. They found them there. They emptied, the cave of all of its water. It was filled with water. That's how these crystals had formed over, a 500,000 years time. And, what does that do for us? You know, it makes you wonder, are there parts of this planet that we're not aware of? So, again, disavowing the whole hollow earth theory too quickly, I think is something that, we shouldn't do. But again, staying on topic with the crypto guys here, I wanted to ask you about the recent levels of sightings of chupacabras, and we seem to have narrowed it down to being this possible hybrid species, Lyle and David, of like a wolf with a coyote or something to that effect, and where it has succumbed to mange and it's possibly even morphed into this whole brand new species of its own. What do you guys think about the chupacabra phenomena? What can you tell us about that?
Well, there are two very distinct types of chupacabra. The first one that was actually reported was very different. It looked alien. It was bipedal. It had very large eyes. In some of the reports, it had a long tail with spikes on the back. The more recent reports that have been pretty widespread, especially in Texas, and Lyle can talk about this, I'm sure, is the creature that he was referring to that appears to be some kind of a hybrid being. Mm-hmm. Now, what's curious is several months ago, I actually received a report of the original type of chupacabra being sighted in Louisiana. And it was a very interesting report. I haven't followed up on it more, but I definitely would like to learn more about that. But Lyle can talk about the Texas chupacabras.
Well, I think it's definitely a case where pop culture has made everybody aware of the chupacabra. And when they started seeing these mangy coyotes down here, the media just basically attach the term chupacabra. So it's an odd circumstance where you have a cryptid that was described in a kind of a completely different fashion and was seen in a different area, Puerto Rico, in the Latin countries, that was, one type of creature, and then they just applied the term to the creature seen in Texas. So I think they're two distinct animals. If the chupacabra exists, it's got to be looked at as two different things. So I call the Texas ones blue dogs, and that's kind of become the term in cryptozoology to identify the two, because if you just say chupacabra, what are we talking about,
Mm-hmm. Oh, that's interesting. Wow, thank you guys for that very much. Yeah, go ahead.
This is Ed, and I was going to say, I think that a lot of the different craft that we see are coming in and out, taking stuff away, bringing stuff back, and I think that a lot of us and a lot of these creatures that are here on Earth has probably came from out in space and been brought here and placed here like a zoo, or like a place of a habitat to where they can survive. And I think that Bigfoot might be a case of that. Who knows what the gorilla was back when, or where it really came from. Is it Earth or space? And we just have so many things that are going on that we can't really close our mind to anything, because the minute you close your mind to something, it'll prove you wrong in a Mm-hmm. few months.
Well, and that underscores why we just have to keep searching and doing close case studies to, if we can get a body possibly, or some better evidence, then these answers, we can answer these questions more specifically.
Thank you guys. Go ahead, Ed.
I'd like to give you a real quick one on something that happened to me in 71. My future father-in-law and I were deer hunting in the Sierras, and it had snowed, and we had dug a log back out of the way and then pulled it in behind us so we could go out in this other area that we knew was going to be great hunting. And when we parked the truck, I sent my father-in-law down one direction, and I went up another to push this big canyon and ridge down to him for deer. And as I was walking along with about 6 inches of snow on the ground, my hair started standing up, and I wasn't knowing why. And I looked over to the side, and there was great big tracks in the snow.
Wow.
That was three of my steps to one of theirs.
Mm-hmm.
And then a mountain lion was following it, a big cat track following it. And I thought at first that this thing was in trouble, getting stalked.
Yep.
And in turn, as I followed their tracks, I found that the Bigfoot would step on the cat's track sometime and smash it down. And sometimes the cat would step on its track and slough it down. So they weren't behind or in front. They were with each other. And that Bigfoot, we followed for 4.5 hours. I got my father-in-law, and we trailed it and followed it for 4.5 hours. And it knew we were there.
Mm-hmm.
And it would lead us up one way, and then it would take off quickly. It opened its stride up and go further away and then drop back down so it would watch us in the brush as we took a turn and went up and was following the tracks. And it was looking at us and studying us, and that went on for 4.5 hours.
Wow. So definitely you had some type of encounter. Thank you, Ed. Thank you very much for that. What I want to do, we only have about 2 minutes left here, so I want to wrap something up. I got a lot of questions on the reptilian subject, and I know that Scotty Roberts is going to be writing a book on reptilians, so I wanted to Yes, you are. You said you were writing a book on reptilians. So what I'd like to do is get you the last question here, and if any of you would like to chime in on that, please do. So Scotty, a lot of people believe that aliens are giving us a reptilian mind, not necessarily reptilians as how we may have been thinking. Well, I'm talking about the reptilian mind. I'm not talking about 8-foot-tall, you know,
right.
scale-covered individuals with massive penises that are raping our women or whatever. I'm talking about aliens giving us a reptilian mind and potentially feeding off of our anxious thoughts, much like people in the paranormal field believe that there are these vampires that feed off of our thought energy. What do you think about all that?
That's very new agey to me, but I can't discount it right off the bat. I'm still in the midst of researching all of this. I will put it to you this way. The subtitle to my book is The Pervasive Presence of the Serpent in Human History, Religion, mm-hmm. and Alien Mythos. So what I am looking at is how, if first of all, do these beings even really exist as literal reptilians from our past? I know we've got lots of information. You look to Sitchin, you got your answer. But there's all sorts of things through history, and since we've only got about 9 seconds left, I'll just say, ask me again in about 4 months.
Sure,
we'll have some more time to talk about it.
Okay, thank you. Well, listen, I know that there's a lot of archaeological digs that are turning up, like in Turkey, Göbekli Tepe, where they're finding, you know, reptilian, strange reptilian type creatures and some of the symbolism that is in the carvings and whatnot. And you know, people like David Icke, you know, have pretty good data.
Don't get me started on David Icke. I don't want to slander or libel anybody here. I don't remember which it is when you're talking on air. But David Icke, just like Sitchin, may be onto something in some of his theories.
Sure.
He may not be totally off, but I will judge somebody's theories and somebody's activities by what they do with their character of life.
Yes.
And one thing that bothers me about David Icke's movement is it's neo-Nazism in different clothes, and he is an anti-Semite.
And I've heard that. I saw this documentary on David Icke and how they alluded to that he is pushing this agenda, this anti-Semitic agenda. I've not seen that symbolism, but maybe somebody like yourself who studied it more closer has. I want to look into that there so that I can form an opinion. But I got to tell you this, Scotty. This reptilian subject matter, whether or not it's talking about the reptilian mind or physical reptilian beings being among us, whenever you throw out the word reptilian, you're going to just stir up the pot and people are going to want to get involved. So, wow, that's interesting. I can't wait for your book.
Well, thank you. It's going to be fun. Yeah.
All right, guys. So, but what I'd like to do is I'd like to thank Micah, Scotty, David, Lyle, Ed, and Jay for being with me tonight on the show. And most importantly, I want to thank Jerry Pippin, Roberta Scott, and Jane Swartley, along with Joe, the producer, for giving us this platform this evening, allowing us to tell everybody about SAC UFO Con. Again, this is the UFO Paranormal Summit. It's happening in Sacramento, California on June 16th and 17th. And all of the individuals that were on the show tonight, including many others, like Paola Leopizzi Harris, Mel Fabregas, Carrie Cassidy, Paul Bradford from Ghost Hunters International, so many individuals. They're all going to be there. I'm excited to have them. Fact or Fake Paranormal Files, Bill Murphy is going to be there. And again, so is Michelle Menny and Norio Hayakawa. So make sure to join us in Northern California this June. It's going to be a fantastic conference. It's going to be a one-of-a-kind conference. Never before has anything like this ever been done. And I'm very proud of everybody who was on the show tonight. All of you performed stellar. You did an amazing job. Thank you so much for being with us. And we look forward to talking with you guys again. And, again, thank you, Jerry Pippin, for having us on the show tonight.